Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 97-year-old Bob Otto of Bakersfield, California. Thanks to his son John for letting us know about his amazing father. I have a few thoughts from John added on to the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. But let's jump back in with Bob right now. So here you are. You're a pilot in World War II. Were you expecting to get sent overseas? Did you have an idea of a specific plane that you wanted to fly in combat?
Well, yes, on all single engine. When we finished primary, well, you went to secondary, which was BT-13s, then advanced, which was the AT-6, which I really liked. I really liked that airplane, and then all aerobatics and so forth. And in fact, I had a Czech pilot, and he tried to do everything to get away from me, and he could not get away from me. And he finally says, well, let's head back to base.
So when you master the AT-6, what was next for a lot of guys was, depending on the time of the war it was, they're going to go fly a P-40, maybe a P-47, eventually maybe a P-51. What happened in your case?
Well, ours was a P-40, which I got to fly. It was a very interesting aircraft, and I know it was redlined at 425, something like that. And I always wanted to speed, and I remember taking it up to 39,000 feet. We were on oxygen. Took it up to, I was on oxygen. Took it up to that altitude and started to dive and got it up to 425. And started my pull-out and landed the aircraft, came back in, and I had an earache when I got back on base. And so with the flight surgeon looked at it and said, you burst your eardrum. And I thought, boy, that's the end of my flying, you know. But within 30 days, it was all healed.
Did that teach you a lesson? That just because that red line's there doesn't mean you have to touch it?
No. You're always looking for something more encouraging, you might say.
So here we have a situation, even though you went in very early in the war, you were already a pilot before Pearl Harbor happened, you enlisted shortly thereafter, you never did get sent overseas in World War II. What were the priorities Uncle Sam had for you?
During World War II, I got as far as Lincoln, Nebraska, which was for overseas shipment to the Far East. And I presumed I'd be headed for China or Burma or that area. And I was walking into the mess hall one day at noon, and the mess sergeant came over to me and said, sir, the war is over. Japan surrendered today. So then I stayed there for probably 3 or 4 weeks, and then got orders to go to Sherman, Texas as a T-6 instructor. And I thought, who in the world will I be instructing? The war's over. There are no students. Well, I got back there, and my students were the combat people that were returning from India and China, and they had to be checked out in the T-6 so they could get their flight pay. That's what I did, checked them out and more or less doing aerobatics with them.
When you say you presume you would have been sent to that part of the war, an often overlooked part of that war, the China-Burma-India theater, do you say that because that's where so many P-40s were with General Chenault and his Flying Tigers?
That's right, yes.
And when you said, you know, that was a very interesting way for you to find out that the war was over, did you have any emotions wrapped up in that news?
No, it was just nice to see that we're at peace with the world.
And you would end up flying 56 combat missions in Korea not too many years later. But I think something pretty important in your life happened between World War II and Korea. You married a special young lady named Etta?
That's right. You know, the love of my life.
What's the story there? How did you two meet?
When I was going to Whittier College, my sister-in-law worked for the telephone company and went on a blind date with this young lady, and that was the beginning of 70 years of best life ever.
Yeah, and I'm sure she had some nervous nights and some long nights and a lot of prayers for a couple years when you were over in Korea flying for the U.S. Air Force by that time. But what about that in-between period? When World War II ended, did you know what was going to be next? Did you have a plan for what you wanted to do with a life that maybe was a little clearer now that the world wasn't inflamed in this giant war?
Oh, yes. I wanted to finish college and get a degree. And my mother had been a school teacher, and my older sister a school teacher. That was more or less what my aim was. So I went to Whittier College, got my bachelor's degree, later went on, got a master's, of course, and a teaching credential, and taught for about 2 years, I guess. And then I was recalled for the Korean War.
I guess I should come back also, because you mentioned when we talked about your trumpet that you had it with you throughout your time in the service. What did that mean to you, and how did you put that talent to use when you were in uniform?
Well, when we were at Arkadelphia, Arkansas, at a CTD, College Training Detachment, they had a band, and on Saturday mornings, why, we would usually march downtown, which was just a few blocks away from the college in Arkadelphia. Didn't play trumpet in that band because the student who was directing it needed a player for a larger instrument, a bass, so I played that in the marching band. I was also the bass bugler. Our quarters were in a huge auditorium, and they had taken the seats out, and we had double bunk beds, but they'd cut the legs so that the beds would be level, and my horn was placed under my end of the bed, and in the morning at 5, the officer of the day would come by and waken me, and I would just stand at the side of my bed and play reveille, and in other words, can't get him up, and in the auditorium, and that would really echo.
Well, and if we look at the odd symmetry of it, there are a lot of servicemen who had their slumber rudely interrupted by your reveille, and many years later you would play the final notes honoring their memories for thousands of funerals, and we'll get to that. But I'm curious for you. Here you are. World War II is over. You were ready to fly for your country then. Now you've finished up school. You're a teacher. You're married. You've got the start to a pretty exciting life. And then, as you told us, you get recalled for the Korean War. Did that blindside you at all? Was that an interruption or an inconvenience? How did you feel about that?
No, there was no problem about it. It was just part of being trained for military, and I was checked out in a different aircraft, the Douglas B-26, and I became a co-pilot on a Douglas B-26.
And that's a very different aircraft from the P-40 you'd been flying at the end of World War II. Help us understand what that airplane is all about, what it's designed to do, what its capabilities were, and how you warmed up to it.
Well, the Douglas B-26 is a twin-engine aircraft. Got R-2800s, so they just gave me training in it. I was a co-pilot for Stan Fields. I was very fortunate to have him as my first pilot. The reason being, he had flown the A-26, which was the forerunner of the Douglas B-26, in Europe during World War II, and was very familiar with the aircraft.
And what were the capabilities of the B-26? How much firepower did you have? How maneuverable was it?
Well, our aircraft was a night outfit, so they were all painted black. We had 6 forward-firing 50s on the wing, not to be mistaken with the solid-nose B-26 that had 6 forward-firing 50s in the nose, plus those in the wing. Of course, as I said, ours did not have that. We were a night outfit, put in 56 missions, 50 night missions, 6 daylight missions. I guess that the 50 missions were required for rotation. 50 night ones were what I presume were required.
And this was with the 731st Bomb Squadron in Korea. How difficult was it to head overseas, to kiss Etta goodbye, not knowing if you're going to come back or not, because this is going to be some pretty dangerous work you're doing?
Yes, well, we took our own airplane. We were out on the desert here. We flew simulated missions. Then on one early morning, while we took off from the desert and came through Bakersfield and on up to Sacramento, and in Sacramento, why, they pulled the radar equipment out of our aircraft and put in a 1,100-gallon bladder tank so that we could fly from Sacramento to Hawaii. And that was a very long flight. That was 18 hours sitting in the same seat. Of course, you're sitting on a one-man life raft, and you have a backpack parachute that you're wearing. We would just trade back and forth flying. I guess I slept a little too along the way. We island hopped from there, and the first island was a man-made island. It was man-made during World War II. It was 1 mile long and about a half mile wide. We landed on that, and then you made a curve around, and they refueled your aircraft, and you got 8 hours sleep, and then you went on to Kwajalein. And there was a very unusual situation that happened in Kwajalein, because just before we landed, there was a Navy R-5D, which like a C-54. It had 26 nurses on board, and when that aircraft broke ground, why, there was an explosion, and the aircraft hit the water and so forth, and all those people lost their lives. And it was probably one of the worst scenes that I have ever seen in my life took place, with the loss of those nurses and the sharks that were in the water at the time. And, of course, the aircraft broke up. And I think about it today and think how horrible it is.
Yeah. And just to have the perspective, I mean, here's your welcome to the war. You're not even over where the combat is yet. You're just landing at Kwajalein, and you stumble across the aftermath of this tragic crash. And at that point, you can see the sharks in a frenzy around that wreckage?
Yes, horrible. And the next day, we refueled. We've had our good night's rest, and we take off, and we don't get quite out to our point of no return, where instead of returning to the base that you started from, you'd go to your next base. But we hadn't quite reached that. We were out about 3 hours and 15 minutes, and we lost an engine. I say lost an engine, but to use that term as a pilot means that the engine quit on you, and we had to feather that engine. We had to return into Kwajalein. We came back, and the whole runway was lined with people looking for what they had seen the day before. And of course, when we landed on a single engine, our crew chief, who was the mechanic for our aircraft, got out, got on his hands and knees. He got out of the nose of the aircraft, which is a glass nose, got on the ground, kissed the ground.
Well, and what about you? Because, I mean, 2 days in a row, you're confronted with pretty visible underscores and reminders that this is a life and death situation. How did you handle that?
No problem. That's what you're hired for, if you want to call it being hired. And that's what you're trained for. In fact, it was a very interesting flight. Well, we went from Kwajalein to Guam, and then Guam all the way to Tachikawa. I got in a poker game in Tachikawa the first night that we were there, and I won a little over $400. And so when we made it to our next base, which was an Australian base at Iwakuni, there were a number of Australian aircraft, and they had float aircraft also. Well, at any rate, I bought a movie camera. That's where most of my pictures came from.
Yeah, and you still have this, and your son has converted it to DVD. And if you go online to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can see a little bit of that film that's nearly 70 years old that Bob took way back when during the Korean War. You said that none of those things bothered you. And I know there was a lot in front of you, 56 missions and most of those at night. But are you saying that you never experienced that fear or question of whether you might leave Etta a widow?
No, you're trained to do what you were to do, and you did it. I never let it bother me.
Well, let's talk about these missions. 56 missions, 50 at night, 6 during the day. Were those daytime missions different in nature than the nighttime ones?
Yes, because you were a target that could be seen during the daytime. Those were a little different type of mission, you might say, than the night ones. The night ones, why, first thing you did was usually about the first 6 of our 50 missions, why we would put Seoul City Sioux off the air. And what you'd do, you'd have her on what we call our bird dog, which is a compass. You would have the compass point towards the station, and you'd head towards the station, and you'd hear in the background that they're having an air raid. Of course, that's you that's going in there, and you'd drop a 100-pounder on the transmitter, and then they'd go off the air, and they'd be off the air then for maybe the entire evening before they could get back on again.
Well, and some people listening have never heard of Seoul City Sioux. Maybe they've heard of Tokyo Rose or Axis Annie or Axis Sally or something like that. Same kind of idea. What did Seoul City Sioux talk about when she was on the radio?
In her very sexy voice, she would say, "Come on, boys, come on over to our side. We'll give you lots of food, good food. You have a nice warm bed to sleep in at night. Of course, it was all a bunch of lies, but it was like, as you say, Access Annie and Tokyo Rose.
So it was a little propaganda, and you had a pretty unique way of silencing it there. You just took out the transmitters. How many times do you think you did that?
I'm sure we did it about 6 or 7 times. On preference, what we would do would be heading for your target area, and then all of a sudden you'd make the turn left so that they wouldn't know that you, in other words, you'd kind of surprise them when you'd come in. That's when you'd drop a 100-pounder, and a Navigator Bombardier would do that, of course, and then do a 180, or if there was anything that moved, why, you would strafe it. And a couple of times there were things that were moving. For example, there was an ammo carrier. We strafed that and stopped it.
And you told us you were the co-pilot. You're in the right seat on this B-26. So what did that mean for your role during one of those missions? What were you supposed to do?
Well, you're an observer. If anything moves, why, you let the pilot know where it is and so forth. When you cross the bomb line, I had a very good vision of trains at night. In fact, the first pilot, Stan Fields, one night we attacked 9 trains in one night. It's literally unheard of, you might say. But what's a train look like at night? It's a white streak. There's you know there's a railroad track down there. So then when the train is on the tracks and so forth, while it's giving off steam, I don't know. I was just able to pick out those trains at night, some 9 of them. When you hit a train at night with your 50 caliber, it's quite interesting, because the steam goes out on each side and it becomes a line, and then you, if you stop the train, then you can strafe it, and you get a number of secondary explosions, and that's what we were able to do 9 different times.
Only because you spotted all 9 of those.
Yes. Well, you were able to. I was able to see them, point them out to the first pilot that was in the driver's seat.
Yeah, I hope this isn't too broad a generality here, but one of the things I've heard from a lot of the veterans I've talked to who served in Korea, and especially a lot of those guys had also served in World War II, and one of the differences that they've pointed out is that during the Korean War, they felt there were a lot of things that were off limits to them, that they might have been able to further the cause or do more damage, but there were areas they were told to stay away from. Is that something that you experienced as well, some boundaries or parameters that you had to maintain?
Yes, but I don't recall it being a problem. For example, I remember about 5 o'clock in the morning when the sun was just coming up, where we were in the northern part of Korea, and we looked across the Yalu River, and you could see all of these Chinese fighter aircraft. They certainly were tempting, but you didn't dare go across that river.
And why wouldn't you dare?
Because that would create an international incident.
And that wasn't the only time he'd find himself in a position like that. When we come back with 97-year-old Bob Otto, what might have been his closest call during the Korean War, and hear how and why Bob has served and honored thousands of his fellow veterans and their families in the years since he left the Air Force. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.